This is Jack and Dino from Seattle, and you're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
I'm speaking with producer Jack and Dino. Is that the title I should give you, producer? You do so much. You're a musician, an engineer.
I just say noise monger these days. I mean, I'm a producer, I engineer, I mix, I do mastering, and I play in four bands right now. So, you know, whatever you want to call me, I make loud noise.
Right on. A day after I first reached out to you, we did an episode covering the Deep Six Various Artists thing, and I stumbled across that your band Skinyard was on there with a couple tracks. Any memories of putting that whole thing together, how it came up, you know, to be the project it is?
Well, those are probably the least successful Skinyard tracks we ever recorded or released, and they probably were the first things we recorded professionally. That was before I started doing my own recordings. But it was where I met Chris Hanzik, who was doing the Deep Six comp, and he had just had a studio that he had lost his building because the landlord had sold it. And while we were in the studio recording my band, he said, "Hey, I'm looking for a building to open my studio again." And I said, "Oh, there's a studio right by my house that just went out of business." And we became partners, and that became Reciprocal Recording in 1986. So the fact that he was recording my band Skinyard for his Deep Six compilation record was kind of, you know, that kind of was what put us together and got this other phase of activity going. You know, when we were both working out of this building as Reciprocal Recording, you know, some of the Deep Six bands immediately came and started recording there with us, and Sub Pop started about a year later, and everything went from there.
Everybody in the band, like yourself, of course, is notable for so much stuff. Daniel House, he would actually go on to be co-owner of CZ, if my information is correct. And Matt Cameron, who everybody knows, went on to Soundgarden and Pearl Jam. Ben McMillan, I couldn't find anything on. Did he kind of give up music after Skinyard?
No, he was in Grunt Truck, for crying out loud. I mean, you know who Grunt Truck was, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, Grunt Truck was Skinyard's third drummer, plus Ben McMillan, our singer.
Okay.
And Tommy from The Accused. And, they coexisted with Skinyard in our last year and a half of existence. And then when Skinyard ended, Grunt Truck became Ben's entire focus, and they got signed to Roadrunner. They made those... Well, I recorded those albums, actually. There's three Grunt Truck albums. One of them only came out like a couple years ago. It was like a posthumous release. But that Ben is actually much, much more well-known for Grunt Truck than he is for Skinyard, because Grunt Truck was on a much higher profile record label than we were.
That doesn't surprise me, because I think maybe if I had heard the name Skinyard before, but I wasn't familiar with the music prior to getting into this Deep Six record, which was actually a fascinating listening, going in and seeing, because there are so many moving parts that would, as far as members of bands, you know, that would go on to do other things that really would define Seattle sound. And this was like, you know, 4 or 5 years before things really blew up.
Oh, yeah. No, it's true. And frankly, you would get a much better picture of Skinyard by listening to anything but the Deep Six record. It's a complete anomaly as far as our sound goes. We completely changed our whole direction after those initial two songs.
You definitely stick out on that record compared to other bands. Yeah, kind of almost proggy. At least by comparison, that's for sure.
We were a little proggy at the time, but compared with Soundgarden and Alice in Chains later, much less so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly later Soundgarden stuff, like as of Bad Motorfinger, got way more proggy than Skinyard ever was.
Okay. Now, I initially wanted to talk to you mainly about Ultra Mega OK because you handled the 2017 Deluxe reissue. If I got everything right here, you actually did the demos for the record, and is it true that you were possibly going to remix the album initially before it came out?
Yes. Kim and I had been talking about me remixing it almost from like a year after the record was released. We were talking about it.
Okay.
Now, I had nothing to do with the record initially other than doing demos for it. You know, I did Screaming Life, which was the band's debut on Sub Pop, mm-hmm. the first EP. And then, you know, we started recording other stuff, and then they got offered this record deal with SST. And Greg Ginn said, hey, I've got a guy to do it. And, you know, Soundgarden said, oh, all right, you got a guy to do it. Let's do that. So they recorded it with this other gentleman who wasn't really that accustomed to doing a band like Soundgarden. And actually, he's a very good engineer, but there's the circumstance in which they recorded it was Soundgarden was going on tour, and they would just kind of do a few days here and a few days there. And, you know, meanwhile, A&M is like calling them up. And, you know, they kind of just weren't. I always got the feeling that they weren't. They kind of took their eye off the ball when they were mixing it.
Okay.
And they kind of settled on something because, oh, we've got to get this record out. And almost immediately, I remember them saying, damn, you know, we should have had you mix it. And, you know, Kim and I talked about it, Kim Thiel. We talked about it for like, I don't know, 23 years, 24 years. I kept calling him and saying, Kim, we're not getting any younger. You know, I think I wrote that in the letter. Okay. We're not going to get younger. We need to do this, you know. And you know, and then Soundgarden broke up, and, you know, it was never going to happen. And then finally when they got back together and Kim became sort of the caretaker of the back catalog, you know, he was the guy in the band who was the most interested in being the curator. It was time, you know. Everybody was into it. You know, he was able to convince Sub Pop to reissue it. They got it away from SST. And, you know, we went and did it. And the thing is, it was mainly Kim and myself doing the mixing. But, you know, we had Matt Cameron and Chris Cornell, you know, involved, like, remotely. Basically, I was sending everybody the mixes as we progressed. You know, okay,
sure.
Mix 7, mix 8. And so everybody was involved in, like, you know, their input. Ben Shepard, of course, isn't on the record, so he pretty much just, you know, said, yeah, you guys do whatever you want. and the original bass player, Hero, was kind of the same way. He's like, oh, yeah, just, you know, knock yourselves out, guys. So really, it was mainly, you know, Kim and Matt and Chris, whose opinions I was going for, and then my own instincts. And it was hard, because it was recorded. It wasn't really recorded the way I would have recorded it, but then every engineer would say that.
Yeah,
you know, we always say, how many light bulbs does it take? You know that old joke. So, you know, but really, actually, it was a pretty good recording, and I didn't have too much trouble with it. It was a little slightly alien to how I do things, but, you know, we managed to get it to sounding pretty good, in my opinion, at least for what I had to work with.
Did you have, like, the original reel-to-reel tapes then, or?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, we had the original reels. That was the point. I was going off. It's not a remastering.
Right. No, I get that. I just wasn't sure how it was presented to you, but.
No. We had the original the original 16-track tapes, transferred them, put them in Pro Tools, you know, modern format. I had the whole everything to work with, actually.
No.
I'm
not sure if the term is correct, but like when a producer like records the effect on the actual track, is that called recording wet? And I guess my follow-up would be, if so, is that how these were, or were they? Did you have just clean raw tracks that you could add any effects to after the fact?
I had clean tracks.
Okay.
That helped a great deal. Because the record actually has a lot of reverb on it originally. It was kind of drenched in reverb. And, you know, that may have sounded okay in 1990, but later it sounded, the record sort of dated. Which you'll notice the first Pearl Jam record, oddly enough, was also drenched in reverb. And entirely independently of anything that I would have done, you know, Pearl Jam ended up remixing that record and taking a lot of the reverb off it.
I compare your remix to that one. I'll tell you right now that Ultra Mega OK was a distant like last place for as far as Soundgarden records. I mainly only owned it just because I was a fan, had to own everything. When I was researching this, I remembered that I saw the deluxe reissue and I read more about it. And so I ended up using those tracks as far as like little, when we're playing like little snippets of stuff to give people a flavor of the song we're talking about. It is a much more pleasurable listen. Like the songs stand out. It sounds more like Soundgarden, if to come up with a dumb way to explain it. Like the original release, just it's kind of muddy to me. It doesn't really. You don't hear the guitars as clean.
No, it's kind of shrill and scratchy and muddy, and just everything's kind of obscured with this weird sound. I mean, exactly the point. It's like, I know what Soundgarden should sound like, for crying out loud, you know? And it was, you know, it was time to do that. So now the record is, you know, it sits comfortably in their catalog where it should have all along. Because those are really good songs.
Absolutely.
That's a good batch of songs that they had there, and they needed to be presented correctly. So, you know, I had the same fun remixing Rehab Doll for Green River a couple of years ago.
Okay.
That was actually equally satisfying. Because that was another record that was done, you know, badly with 80s aesthetics that I had nothing to do with other than bring it. You know, again, I did the demos for it, and you know, later the record came out, and I sort of thought, what happened? But it was also another case where the band had broken up while they were mixing the record. You know?
Yeah,
never works out very well, you know, so I got to remix Ultra Mega. I got to remix Ultra Mega, and then a couple of years ago, Jeff, I met Jeff at Chris Cornell's funeral. He said, look, now's the time to remix that thing. Go ahead and do it. And I said, okay.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. Well done.
Is
the original producer, what's his name? Dino? I'm going to butcher his name. Dino Camulet?
His name was Drew.
Drew. See,
Drew Camulet. Yes, Drew Camulet. He's the original producer engineer. And he has he's got a very good discography, good reputation. He's worked with a lot of cool stuff.
Do you happen to know if Drew ever heard your remix?
I don't know, because I actually don't know Drew. I don't know how to reach him. I don't have his phone number. I have no idea. I hope he likes it. I just don't really know.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, wherever he is, God bless him, because he gave me a really good track to work with.
Yeah, all right. You mentioned Hero. What's he up to?
He's in a band called Stereo Donkey. Hmm. They're kind of a surf band. But I say that very guardedly because they're sort of not really a stereotypical surf band. They're quite a bit more than that. So,
well, I'll check. I'll look them up, man.
My own band, NKB Ultra, has played two shows with Stereo Donkey. They're pretty cool.
NKB Ultra?
MKB. MKB okay. Ultra. Yes, it's called MKB Ultra. That's one of my four bands.
Well, you got to stay busy, right?
I do.
Let me get some quick thoughts on you on a couple of the other records on the list. Then you did Green River Dry as a Bone, which came in at number 20.
Originally, yes, did that on the 8-track. That's one of the very first records I recorded at Reciprocal.
Any special memories from doing that? It was an EP. If I got my notes right here,
it was an EP, the deluxe reissue. Now you should know that Green River did three records in total. The first record was called Come On Down, and they recorded it with Chris Sanzik in like 1984, 1985, before Deep Six. And then I did Dry as a Bone at Reciprocal in 1986. And then they went and they recorded Rehab Doll, which was their third and final record in, 1987, 88. It would have been 87. And I had nothing to do with that until I got to, you know, remix it. Dry as a Bone I didn't remix because it was fine the way it was. I was happy with my work. What I was able to do for the deluxe reissue, because both Dry as a Bone and Rehab Doll have been deluxe reissued as double vinyl and long CD. Because Dry as a Bone, actually, there was an album's worth of material. Sub Pop only chose to release five songs. But there were actually eight or nine songs recorded at the time. So the Dry as a Bone reissue has been filled out with those songs plus some other stuff that I discovered that nobody had ever heard before, that they had recorded elsewhere that had never been mixed. Plus the two songs from the Deep Six record were added to the Dry as a Bone reissue that came out a couple years ago. So, and I got to remaster the whole thing from the original tapes, which had never been used. So the Dry as a Bone now is a much better record. And then Rehab Doll was a whole other story because I got to remix the album and add my own 8-track demos of the same album onto it. So the Dry as a Bone reissue is also kind of a, it's, well, excuse me, did I say Dry as a Bone? I meant Rehab Doll.
Yeah, okay.
The Rehab Doll reissue is, I remixed the album plus was able to add the 8-track demos that nobody's heard. So it's kind of like what I did with Ultra Mega Okay. It's a different record now. And you'll listen to it and realize that this is a way better band than you thought they were.
Well, I'll definitely check it out. And I'll probably use the deluxe edition for when we get to Dry as a Bone as well.
Do that. And then I also Rehab Doll once again was an 8-song record when it came out, but 10 songs were recorded at the time. So now it's just a brilliant record. I had no idea the band was that good because, again, it was a record that was drenched in reverb and had, like, terrible 80s production applied to it.
Yeah, okay. You're probably giving yourself a little too much of a hard time, but...
Well, I didn't record Rehab Doll.
Oh, right. Sorry. I got my wires crossed myself.
It was like Ultra Mega. It was like Ultra Mega. Okay, it wasn't Drew Candle. It was a different guy who recorded it. It was someone else. Never mind. I'm actually patting myself on the back too much, to be honest. So
I get it now, yes.
Let's stop this right now, but I'm just telling you, if you like this music, you need to hear the remix of Rehab because you will really enjoy it because it's just fucking rock. It's just a way better record.
Yeah, there are about 4 records on this list that I'm not familiar with, and Green River is one of them, so I'm going to go kind of a deep dive on them, I think, in my prep. But, of course, Mark Arm would go on to do Mudhoney, and you took care of the record that came in at number 5, Super Fuzz Big Muff, again, an EP.
Yep. I think we recorded a few other songs at the time, which I don't know where they ended up, but probably on singles.
No deluxe edition of that one yet?
There is a deluxe. Oh, no, the deluxe edition of that has been out for years, actually.
Okay.
Not all the extra tracks are all on it, actually. So, no, that's been available forever. The original record was 5 songs, I think. 5 or 6, I don't remember. The CD issue that's been out forever is like, you know, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10 songs, something like that.
Okay.
I'm almost certain. There's at least 1 extra song. Now, remember, the first thing I recorded for them was Touch Me, I'm Sick.
Mm-hmm.
It was the single. And Touch Me, I'm Sick was a 7-inch and Sweet Young Thing. And that pretty much was the opening salvo that sort of put them on the map. That got everybody's attention. And then we did the EP. And, you know, I did the second record as well. And then later I did, I think it was the 4th or 5th record, My Brother the Cow. So I got to work with them. Yeah, I got more than my share of Mudhoney time. And I always loved those guys. They're a brilliant band.
Was there any talk of you doing Piece of Cake when they signed to a major label?
No.
Okay. That's a quick answer. I'll tell you this. Coming at number 13 on the list is probably a band you get asked about the most. Nirvana, you did the Bleach album.
Sure.
Is it true you did that for a flat fee of about $600?
Well, it was a flat fee. We were charging hourly at the time, but I think the studio was only like $12 an hour or something.
Okay.
But that's what it came to. It was like something like $606 and some change. The number has been, I know Michael Azard had printed the number in his book. I don't remember the precise number. It was $606 and something. That was when, you know, I went back and looked at the studio log sheets and just added the fees up, and that's what I came up with. It was a pretty quick one. It was 8-track, you know,
mm-hmm.
But I knew they were a brilliant band.
Could you kind of see what they were going to become, or is that's just too hard to predict?
It was hard to predict. I didn't know they were going to become I didn't know the songwriting was going to become as poppy as it did. And I say that term very loosely.
Mm-hmm.
I knew they were a brilliant band. The thing is, I record a lot of bands that I think are brilliant bands. That doesn't mean the rest of the world will agree.
Yeah, so, I can relate to that.
Know, yeah, who knew, you know? I mean, what happened was certainly not to the degree that I would have expected.
How long did it take to record?
Something. I mean, in total studio time, it was something like 30 hours.
Oh, I guess we could do the math, huh? You said $12 an hour.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't know if that math works out, actually, because I was always a little bit I was pretty flexible about it, what hours I actually wrote on the
lot. Sure.
But it was something like that. I mean, it was, you know, I remember working out one time. It was 30-something.
Well, that one got a 20th anniversary edition. Were you asked to be involved in that at all?
Yeah, I supervised the remastering, and also the 20th anniversary, the full double deluxe edition just got a complete live show on it as the second disc, which
okay.
was a show that they performed in Portland around that time, 1990, I think it was. Again, we had actual multi-track. And as a matter of fact, the multi-track, I think, was recorded by the same guy that did Ultra Mega OK. I think
okay.
it was recorded by, I'm pretty sure Drew Canyonette recorded that multi-track. I had the 16-track tapes to work from for the bonus live show, and that was pretty satisfying. Because there's some songs on there that I don't think live versions exist anywhere of them.
Okay.
A couple of the songs from Bleach that never got played after that. Yeah, actually, I think those are the only live versions of a couple of songs. But yeah, and I got to supervise the remastering. I didn't do the remastering myself, but I got a guy named George Marino in New York. Yeah, I think he's dead now, but I think he did for me, and he did the mastering. I think he did the mastering. He might have been dead by the time we did Ultra Mega OK. I can't honestly remember who did
okay.
that. That might have been a different guy. But I did get George Marino to do Bleach. I was pretty happy about that, and he did a great job.
He did a ton of CD masters when CDs first started to be kind of more common in record stores. Just a lot of old albums.
He did like the Zeppelin box set, you know, when Jimmy Page basically said it's time to remaster these CDs because all these original CDs sound terrible. And, you know, he did a bunch of stuff for the Hendrix estate, and I thought, this is the guy to remaster, please, because he's going to respect the original sound. He's not going to squash it and make it sound all stupid and modern.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, I had a long talk with George. I said, look, this is, you can't go squashing this and making it, you know, five times louder than it was, and compressing the hell out of it. Because everybody's used to the way it already sounds. So it needs to sound better, but it doesn't need to sound dramatically different. You're not, there's no problem that you're solving here. It's not like a, you know, it's like you don't fix it if it isn't broke. It was just a matter of just a conscientious and just a better sound, really. And, you know, because we were dealing with masters that were 20 years old. And, you know, digital technology has come a long way
mm-hmm.
in the last 25 years.
Very much so.
Those old CD masters, just there are many reasons why they don't sound that good. And one of them is that the technology just wasn't that good then, and we
mm-hmm.
have much better technology for making digital masters now, regardless of what decisions are taken in the master itself. The actual underlying technology is much more high fidelity. So it was basically, I told him, let's apply the doctor's motto here, which is first do no harm. Yeah, that was, and I was happy with that I was allowed to be involved in that, because, you know, I basically approved it. And he did the work. I just did the mixing of the live material that
okay.
was added.
Being that you had worked with him on the album prior, and, you know, just being someone who's clearly a pretty major part of the Seattle scene at the time, probably still, but did you get a chance to hear Nevermind before it was released?
No.
What?
I didn't. In fact, the first time I... Now, here's the thing. They did do some recording with Butch Vig before they went and recorded for the major label album. In other words, they did some recording with Butch Vig for what would have been the second Sub Pop record.
And do you know if that was done in Pachyderm?
Yeah, I think it probably was. Those
okay.
demos were done with Chad Channing on drums. And I think there are five or six songs. I think there's one song that wasn't, then five or six songs that were ultimately re-recorded for Nevermind that was on that tape. So, and they gave that tape, I had a copy of the tape, and so did quite a few people around here, because they gave it to Sub Pop as, like, you know, here's some songs that we think are going to be on the second Nirvana record. But right then, Geffen came along and blew that whole, you know, thing out of the water. So I think all of that stuff has probably ended up on the various Nirvana reissues or box sets or whatever, you know. It's all ended up getting released eventually.
Yeah.
So I heard basically, you know, half of the songs, something like that, before it became a major label record.
When you finally got to hear the whole finished Geffen release, what were your first thoughts? Do you even recall?
Well, I was out on tour with Skinyard at the time.
Okay.
And we started hearing it. People, somehow we were in Europe when the record came out, and tapes of it, you know, had been leaking out, promo cassettes, because that's, of course, what people did in 1980 or 1991.
Right.
Promotional cassettes is what the record labels would send out. And various people had gotten promotional cassettes of it in Europe as we were touring. And they were losing their minds over this record. Like, what the hell is this? And, you know, we started hearing it. The promoter would have a copy of it and would play it over the club PA while we were setting up, or we would hear it. You know, it was kind of crazy starting to hear this record and thinking, wow, this is amazing, what's happening. But that's another story. I think technically the record may have come out. Did it come out in September or October? What was
I believe it was definitely fall. I want to say September 91.
And I think the first time we heard it, I think my band was touring in the Midwest, and we heard Smells Like Teen Spirit on the car radio, and we almost lost our minds. It was like, what? And then we went to Europe immediately after that in October, and that is when it started really blowing up, and we started hearing people at home. We would call back home, and people would be like, this record is entering the charts, you know, and it's been there.
How important do you think Dave Grohl, being the drummer on that, was to that album's success?
I don't know. That's a good question, because Dave himself would and has publicly admitted that he was actually playing Chad's drum parts almost exactly. You know, the drum parts on the demos that they made when Chad was in the band are substantially similar to the drum parts that are on those same songs.
Okay.
Never mind. But, you know, Dave is a much harder player. He's a much harder hitter. He's a more explosive drummer. And, you know, Teen Spirit was not on the original demos. That was a new song.
Okay.
There's no Chad version of Teen Spirit. That's all Dave. So, you know, Teen Spirit was the song that just, you know, blew them wide open. And that was a new song that was written with Dave Grohl in the band.
So, and that definitely is an iconic drum open.
It really is. I mean, you know, there's a few iconic drum parts on that record. And also, In Utero has some incredibly iconic drum parts that are, you know, it's pure Dave.
Sure.
So Dave was huge in, I think, you know, especially for their live shows, because he's so rock solid and such a hard hitter and just so explosive. You cannot discount that.
Well, that album was definitely a game changer. There's no doubt there. It comes in at number one on the list. Spoiler alert to anybody listening to the show.
Of course.
So I'm dropping like little snippets of yours and all the guests I have on the show. How would you sum up that record looking back? I mean, it just changed everything. I don't think it's undersold how much grunge changed music starting with that record.
Well, it was funny for me, and I'll tell you why. Because for me, grunge had peaked in 1989. You know, because I was involved in it, and I saw the English press going nuts for Ted and Mudhoney and all this other stuff. And you know, Soundgarden was already well on their way. Remember, we had major label records already in the pipeline before the pipeline.
Alice in Chains,
Soundgarden. I think Screaming Trees. Now, I don't know. I'm trying to think if the first Screaming Trees record may have come out around the same time. But Screaming Trees already had like four or five albums under their belt, even though they were indie records, you know, before. And none of those albums were on Sub Pop. There was an EP. So there were bands that already were in the pipeline working their way through it and getting people's attention when Nevermind just kind of dropped out of nowhere and just blew everybody out of the water. So the thing was already happening. Bands were already getting signed. People were already talking with major labels. They were already sniffing around Seattle looking for grunge bands. You know, and Nirvana was just one of those bands that got snatched up at that time. But you got to remember Pearl Jam, too, around the same time. Pearl Jam came. You know, so this was not... Nirvana was not an isolated phenomenon, is what I'm saying.
No. I mean, it definitely opened the doors for a lot of those bands.
Yeah.
Pearl Jam.
Well, I'm saying the doors were already open for a lot of those bands already.
All right.
a lot of those bands had already been signed to major labels.
Some
of them already had major label records out before Nevermind appeared. I could be wrong.
No, you're definitely right, factually, as far as...
I think it's possible that Facelift and Louder Than Love may have been released earlier than that.
They definitely were, and I think... I don't have it in front of me. I think Bad Motorfinger was slightly ahead of it as far as release date. Wasn't that 91? Or was that...
Yes, I think it may have been. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was around the same time, and I also think... don't forget Mother Love Bone.
Right.
We had a record out before any of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's also Queens Rock and that whole other business that gets pretty much overlooked, the metal bands. So, there was stuff coming out. There was stuff from Seattle that was getting into the major label pipeline. And this was like when Nevermind came out, it was like suddenly whacking everybody on the head with a 2x4. It was like, wait a minute, there really, really, really is something happening here in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, the whole world just became laser focused on what was going on here, and people just suddenly discovered all these other bands that had been signed to major labels: The Trees, Soundgarden,
Melvins,
Pearl Jam, the Melvins. Yeah, Melvins got signed a little bit later. That's more or less post Nirvana they got signed.
Okay,
and Mudhoney also around the same time. You know, so it was a pretty interesting. Period, actually. And, Nirvana basically really focused everybody's attention because, people went, holy shit, there's, not only are these bands good, but this one is on the top of the charts. What the hell does this mean? So
everybody from JCPenney was marketing clothes in a couple of years. I remember there were guitar pedals. I want to say DOD or Digitech had one that was called the Grunge pedal.
I have one. Somebody gave me one years ago. They said, here, you need to own this. Okay.
Do you think that's ridiculous?
No, it sounds great. It sounds like a super. The pedal sounds exactly like a Super Fuzz, which was a classic fuzz pedal from the 60s. It's basically a reissue of the Super Fuzz, from what I can tell.
And that's where the album title Super Fuzz Big Muff came from, was those two pedals.
Of course,
correct?
Yes, because those guys have those pedals.
Well, do you like the term grunge, or is it something that kind of irritates you because it turned into a product?
Well, it irritated me plenty at the time. Now I don't really care.
Okay.
In retrospect, here's the thing: is that at the time when the grunge thing exploded, I kind of got pigeonholed somewhat as being like the grunge guy. And the fact is, at this point, I've made like 600 plus records in 14 countries, and most of them have nothing to do with anything that you would call grunge. They're just rock records of all genres, really. So enough time has passed that I don't really concern myself with it anymore, because my career has its own direction, and there's enough records that people have heard that nobody associates me with that particular thing. But there's always people who are like, yeah, we want this particular vocal reverb, or we want this guitar tone. And I go, okay. Well, I remember how to do that, But for the most part, I'm not still wearing those block ears, if you will. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
That kind of where you get sort of typecast in one role.
Yeah.
It took me a while to get past that, but by the end of the 90s, when I was doing Zeke and Zen Gorilla and the Makers and the Murder City Devils, and that whole second wave of Seattle rock bands came about, and nobody was talking about grunge anymore by then. And that was 20 years ago, so things are fine.
Yeah, and I definitely encourage anybody to go to your website, jackanddino.com, and look at you've worked at... I couldn't believe how long the list was. It's just amazing. You must never have any free time to do stuff like this.
I don't. I'm pretty much doing this 24/7. And, I need to add, 30 more records to that list. I haven't updated it. I haven't updated it in almost, a year. I need to, this is one of those things I just don't have time to deal with.
I have one last question for you, and I'm asking everybody this. So hopefully this doesn't come off too dumb because of where you're coming from. But grunge gets blamed for killing hair metal a lot. What's your opinion? Did grunge kill hair metal? I'm talking Warrant, those kind of bands.
Yes, please. Yes, it did. I mean, I think it would have died anyway because it was, here's the thing, is that particular thing had become extremely formulaic.
Yeah, you think?
Extremely formulaic. And, you know, any popular musical style becomes formulaic.
It happened to grunge.
You know, the grunge thing did, too, because yeah. I always considered the later bands that had nothing to do with Seattle to be somewhat trend jumpers. I'm not mentioning any names.
Sure.
Some of those records sounded extremely derivative to me. Like, oh, you just happen to have this sound, you know. What a coincidence. And, you know, I still hear bands like that from time to time. Some of them are even bands that I've recorded, but they're from other countries. I give them a pass. But you know, there was definitely some sort of formulaic thing going on in the 80s. There was like it was almost like there was a hair metal factory in L.A., you know, that just kept cranking out these bands with dumb names and dumb hairdos. and all of them presented themselves as metal bands and heavy rock bands, but they always had a sappy power ballad, which was the one that would get on the radio,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was a fairly cynical way of, basically it worked for Ozzy, and so everybody else wanted to do that same formula. God bless Ozzy. I don't knock Ozzy for anything. It's his own deal. But,
right.
you know, everybody thought, well, if we make a sappy ballad with strings and have, you know, in the middle of the other 10 hard rock songs on our record, we'll get on the radio, and it worked over and over again. But I'm not really an authority on this because I didn't really like that stuff.
Well,
you know,
you're an authority on the Seattle scene, and you know the impact.
Yeah,
it has,
but so. I mean, I'm not an authority on hair metal. I mean, I started to me that the good bands were Zeppelin and Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and AC/DC, and pretty much the '70s hard rock stuff was what I grew up with. You know, and for that matter, Motorhead and Iron Maiden and bands like that. I mean, I loved that stuff when it came out. You know, and then by the late 80s, it was like everything was drenched in keyboards and reverb and you know, drama and corniness. And what's happened here, you know? Where's rock and roll? We need some actual rock. And luckily, I found myself in a position to make some.
And there's no doubt that the bands that came out of Seattle that really hit all had their own sound, too. Like, they were identifiable.
Well, yeah. I'm glad to hear you say that they didn't all sound the same, because really... You know, does Mudhoney sound like Soundgarden?
No.
Does Pearl Jam sound like Alice in Chains? No, not really. You know, do the Melvins sound like any of the above? No.
To their credit, Pearl Jam doesn't even sound like Mother Love Bone, really.
No, they don't at all. They never did.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. Was there anything else you wanted to promote?
Let's see. I'm in a band right now called Sky Christ Mary, which has been around for many, many years. I'm in a current version of the band, and we just released a record last week. It is called, oh, geez, what's it called? See, that's how brain dead I am. What band is this one, day of the week? The band is called Secrets of a Red, or the album is called Secrets of a Red Planet, and this came out a week ago, like literally, I think, last Friday. And I play guitar on it, and Kevin Whitworth from Love Battery plays guitar on it.
Okay.
So it's very much of a guitar rave-up reimagining of this band. Sky Christ was kind of a space rock band in the 90s and 2000s. Didn't really fit in with the Seattle grunge thing. But for some reason, myself and the other guitarist from Love Battery have wound up in this version of the band, and it's much more of a guitar psych version of the band. So I think it's going to throw people for a loop a little bit. Let's see. My own band, MKB Ultra, has two records out, and we're working on a third. We made our last record free on Bandcamp just actually last week.
Okay.
The first song on the record is called Dress for the End of Time. And it's a very cynical song, and it's very topical now, strangely enough. And, let's see, I'm in a psych band called Beyond Captain Orca. And this band is instrumental and has no singer, no songs, no rehearsals, and no overhead. It's guitar, bass, and drums, and we basically get on stage and improvise for a half an hour. And we record every, you know, and put them up on Bandcamp each time, and most of them are multi-track recordings now. So it's kind of like, you know, if you want the Grateful Dead, there it is, you know. It doesn't sound like the Dead because we're much, much, much different. We're coming from a much different direction. And it's definitely not for everybody. It's music for long attentional spans, but there seems to be a fan base developing for it, so whatever. Beyond Captain Orca on Bandcamp. And then the last band is called The Purple Strange, And we are about to release a record, and this is of interest because this is myself on guitar, and the other guitar player from Love Battery is playing on it, which is Ron Menig. So Ron and I are the two guitar players in that band, and Kurt Danielson from Cavs is playing bass for it.
Oh, wow.
So it's a little grunge mafia thing going on with this band called the Purple Strange, actually. And we've only released, I think, one song officially. It's on SoundCloud somewhere.
You said it's called The Purple Strange?
The Purple Strange is the name. Or actually, it's just Purple Strange.
Okay.
And so that, literally, the record is recorded, and we're just sort of trying to finish the cover art so we can figure out some way to release it. And with everything going on right now, I don't know how that's going to come about. It might just be digital only. But there is a single on SoundCloud, and we've only played, I think, 3 or 4 shows. So go figure. Some of us here in Seattle just can't stop playing music is what it amounts to. I'm in 2 different bands with the 2 different guitar players from Love Battery right now. Go figure.
Can we find all this on your website? By the way, let me say that web address again. Endino.com, your last name, Endino.com.
Correct. JackAndDino.com also routes to it.
Okay.
The underlying domain name is Endino. Use whichever one you wish.
Well, Jack, you gave me way more time than I think we anticipated, but I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yes, thank you. Well, I hope it goes well. I didn't know you were doing a podcast. I thought it was going to be a printed thing, but hey, whatever.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I made it clear, but if I didn't, I apologize.
No, I just probably skimmed over with my eyeballs. I hope your audio is good enough for this. We seem to have a pretty good connection.
Is this Jack?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Jack. Baco from Cobras and Fire. I emailed you a little while ago, a couple days ago.
Yep. No, I know. I remember. I actually just was almost not going to answer your call, and then I remembered, like, oh, right.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.